Hello, folks. How are you this week? You might hear a slight spring in my step in my voice. That's because my two amazing young children went back to school this week. Not only a joy for me in terms of being able to get work done, but for them. Seeing an extra sparkle in their eyes as they get to sit in classrooms with their peers and have conversations and play and just be in a really positive, wonderful environment has been fantastic to watch. So I would just like to say a massive thank you to all the teachers out there for all the incredible work that you do. I am in awe of you. Thank you so much from the bottom of my heart. Slightly off subject, but I thought it was a lovely place and opportunity to say so. And so on to this week's episode. I'm so excited about this one because this interview, I mean, all the interviews I have to say are very enjoyable and fun to do. And each one is very different from the previous and to the next. But there was something really special about this one. And our latest guest on Soundtracking is a writer, a director returning for a second sitting, who has made 5 outstanding films for the BBC about London's West Indian community, Steve McQueen. Now, his Small Axe anthology are historical dramas spanning from the late 60s to early 80s, from the story of the legendary Mangrove Restaurant to Red, White and Blue, which stars the awesome John Boyega as Leroy Logan, the man who founded the Black Police Association. Now, as you'd expect, the music is exquisite, of which plenty more shortly. But first, a word from our friends at LinkedIn. Now, by all accounts, 2021 is looking up. There seems to be light at the end of that extraordinary long tunnel that we've been in. And one thing that has helped me cope with the pandemic is making this podcast, being able to talk about film and music and making it with the most amazing, inspiring team. That team is Ben, who makes it sound absolutely brilliant. Ben, I owe you everything, my friend. Thank you so much. Having the right people on your team is something that can really inspire and encourage creativity. And LinkedIn is one of the best places to help you find that team. It's an active community of professionals with more than 30 million members in the UK alone. So if you're thinking ahead, considering shifting business hours or maybe hiring more remote employees, LinkedIn Jobs can help you. You can post a job with targeted screening questions, which will get your role in front of the qualified candidates, helping you find the right person quickly. Then when you need to manage your posts and contact candidates, you can do that from linkedin.com. And you can also do all this from your mobile device. And to lend a helping hand, we've arranged for your first job post to be free. LinkedIn Jobs can help you hire the right person faster. So when your business is ready to make that next hire, find the right person with LinkedIn Jobs and post a job for free. Just visit linkedin.com/sound. Again, that's linkedin.com/sound to post a job for free. Terms and conditions apply. And so to Steve McQueen. And special bonus guest for part of our conversation, Denis Bevel, whose classic song Silly Games is central to one of the films Lovers Rock. So where else could we start than with that track as sung by the awesome Janet Kay? I've been wanting you. We'll be right back. so much for your time today. I mean, it feels extra special that we've got Dennis here to talk about, well, this one particular episode of this incredible collection of stories. I guess, Steve, if you don't mind, I'm just going to get straight into it with regards to, to that episode in Lover's Rock, just in terms of how much that song, I guess, influenced the entire mood and atmosphere of that particular film, really, because it feels like it's the score almost. I mean, I know there's lots of other music in there, but it feels very much like it's the journey of the film almost in a way.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a fairy tale, Lover's Rock. It was based on my aunt leaving my grandmother's house in Shepherd's Bush in the middle of the night. My grandmother wouldn't let her go to blues parties, so my uncle used to leave the back door open for her. And then she used to go and to Labra Grove party all night and then come back home, you know, early hours of the morning before church. And within that narrative, it was always based around that song. You know, it was always based around silly games. And that was it. So I had the head, I had the tail, I had the heart. So that was how we started it.
And how did the relationship with Dennis kind of, in terms of his involvement and his appearance in it, how did that start?
Well, I was introduced, thank God, to Dennis through Paul Gilroy, an academic, and a leading a British academic. And we just hit it off. And at first, you know, it was kind of funny because I was talking to Dennis about music and at the time and so forth and whatnot. He was making some music for me. And then Dennis sort of said, well, I want to be in it. I want to be the bus driver. No, sorry, the bus conductor. I said, oh, okay. And I said, well, look, you know what? I've got other plans for you. And that's what happened. So, yeah.
I actually had the pleasure of chatting to you a couple of years back about this song because I made a documentary for Sky Arts called Songs to Have Sex To. And one of the songs, it wasn't a kind of chart thing. It was more about the kind of psychological, physical effect that music can have on you. And we came and talked to you at length about this song. It's just amazing how it has this timeless quality to it as well. Even though it does transport you back to a time, you still hear it now and there's a connectivity to it. Can you remember going back to the creation of that song and what the intention was with the song, really?
The intention was to create something that was infectious, you know, quite frankly.
It worked.
I wanted to dethrone Sly Dunbar as reggae's top drummer by inventing a drum pattern that I thought he'll have to try and work this pattern out. And it was an unusual drum pattern for a reggae song. And when I taught the pattern to a drummer by the name of Drummy Zeb, him from Aswad, and I said, look, you're a drummer. I've got this idea. I want to hear this for 4 minutes. And he went, wow, magic. Because, you know, when I showed him how the pattern was put together with like calypso hi-hat feel, you know, the offbeat snare drum feel of Afrobeat, and then the four beats to the floor disco, you know, that was 120 BPM that was going on at the time, all the disco things that are still going on at that tempo. And I said, right, can you hold that down? And when the bass is playing the slow part, do 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 do. That's the verse of the song. And when it plays the fast part, it goes, doom, boo-doom, boo-doo-doo-doo, boo-doo-doo-boo. That's the chorus of the song. So we had to kind of change the tempo very slightly for the chorus and ease it back in for the verse, right? And he had to understand that the chorus of the song had to move up a half a beat in tempo and then sit back for the verse. And at that time, drum machines weren't able to do that. So we were creating a new beat. And in fact, my intention was to make lots of songs with that same beat, right? But after the success of Silly Games, I didn't dare use that drum beat on another song again.
What I love about what you just said, Dennis, it's kind of really a British diaspora tune. It's Afrobeat, it's the American influence, it's the West Indian influence, and of course, the British invention.
Coming together in London.
Spectacular. Pretty spectacular.
Yeah. The other thing was that Drummy Zeb is of Grenadian roots, and I am of Barbadian roots. And there we were, trying to topple the Jamaican phenomenon. And in fact, when I told Janet of the high note that it had to be, you know, and she went, what?
Still got it, wow.
You can do that? I must be able to do that. No problem. And she sat on it like a bird floating, you know, on air.
Yeah. Was she always the choice for you know, to deliver this performance for this track? Was she always the person that you wanted?
She once said to me, I wish I'd never met you. Why? She said, can you imagine what it has to be after I've been doing a concert, then to have to do that song at the end of the concert,
end
right,
of the concert.
After I've been singing for an hour, and hit that note. She said, but now I've got a new idea. What she does is she puts the microphone to the audience and goes, and your turn. And they, what in the audience, you know, scrambles for the note. And I went, clever girl.
To be part of this film, which, you know, Steve's done, I'm going to talk hopefully at a bit length about all these different brilliant films that I think are just, for me, they just really show off this brilliant achievement of these characters in terms of what they've kind of set out to do and achieve within their lives. And this one obviously being, you know, around this kind of beautiful love story and this, you know, that, you know, reflecting on those, being a teenager and wanting to get out and hang out with your friends, where you have this kind of sort of strict barrier of parents and things around you. But I think that there's just something absolutely beautiful about how this story's been told. And Dennis, for you being part of it, I know you wanted to be the bus conductor, but to be totally in the heart of this wonderful recreation of your song as well, and the way that Steve chose to represent it with this kind of a cappella live rendition within this party, which just I found myself not breathing for the entire time that this was going on, because it was so brilliant to watch. What was that like for you, Dennis, to see this song have another life within this beautiful project?
It was melancholic. You know, there was times when I was holding back the tears, because I think to myself, when I created this thing, I had no idea that it would, you know, reached to this stage where 40 years later, I'm in a room with budding young black actors and actresses, and they know the song, and they're at least three generations away from the creation of the song. I had to correct a few of the words for them, because you know, the opening line of the song says, I've been wanting you. And everyone's taken to singing, I've been watching you. I'm saying, no. Wrong word, wanting. Those youngsters were like, oh, we thought it was watching, you know, and that was amazing. And there were a few other words that they had misconstrued. But largely, the fact that everyone was waiting for that high note to come and attempt it was like trying to watch the pole vault at the Olympics. You know, is he going to hit the bar, or is he going to scale it? Unfortunately, having stood in many audiences where I've told Janet, don't tell them I'm in the audience, right? Because, you know, and she'd be on stage, and I'd be sat in the mosh pit, kind of hearing young girls scream their head off and thinking, yeah, you did it, you didn't, you did, you did, you know, and having a who did it in the dance.
Well, I guess with that casting of that particular actor for that scene, Steve, in terms of making sure it was someone who could hit that note.
Yes. I mean, I think what was interesting for me was how the song transcended and transformed into a real want and a real need, into a situation of if it's emancipation, spiritual sort of transportation, whatever. It was something which it transcended the, you know, sometimes you need a fire in order to sort of, for it to create, go into something else. And that's what happened with that song. It was very spiritual in that room. Things were happening, which, it, you know, occurred. It just occurred, and he was very happy that we had a camera and we had a microphone to record it. You know, I mean, it would have happened if there were no cameras or no microphones. We were just privileged to be there to record it.
Steve, I got to say yet again, thank you for the realization that those words could mean something else to another situation in life. For instance, it just struck me as we were doing the a cappella there about the games that people play with other people, the silly games, and the fact that the people involved there were going, look, we've had enough of those games, you know, and it gave the song a wider meaning for me, and it made me feel, hey, you know, it was a better creation than I thought in the beginning, and it had a lot more meaning. You know, the meaning was not, it wasn't a mono meaning that you'd like multiplied the meaning.
Dennis, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. I really appreciate it. It makes this episode really special to be able to have you here to just celebrate this wonderful thing that you created 40 years ago. It's lovely to see you as well, looking so well. So thank you so much for your time. Thank you, Dennis.
Have a good day. Love yourself. Bye.
Oh, amazing. Brilliant. What a legend. Steve, these five films are they're just absolutely brilliant. Huge congratulations on you know what you've done with these. And I didn't realize that this has been something that's been in you've been working on for so long. They've been the sort of gestating away kind of thing for years for you in terms of, you know, of wanting to get them out in a way. But I wanted to ask if the idea was always that it would be a collection of stories rather than these characters being in one film.
Yeah, I think that at the beginning, that was the idea. I thought it would be like one family. But the time frame was the same, 68 to 84. And the reason for that time frame is that was the same time as the mangrove being open. It was the year the mangrove opened. It was the same year of the Rivers of Blood speech by that man who I won't even mention his name. So it was one of those situations where when I started research, there were so many stories. I thought, well, I can't it be in one family fictional story of one family passing through this time. It should be about all of these interesting stories. And the mangrove was one which was really kind of prominent to me. And I wanted to sort of, you know, sort of tell that story. And unbeknownst to me, you know, my father was a close friend of Roland Gordon. You know, they grew up together in the place called Paradise in Grenada. He was always at our house, but I never knew that Roden was part of the Mangrove Nine. And it was, you know, it was one of those things because the post-stress disorder, which went on after Mangrove Nine, you can imagine. I mean, he got after the trial, you know, everyone was beaten up and put on the false charge and put in prison because that's what people could do back then. And even now, I mean, people did that. Mangrove Nine trial was one of the victories, but they, you know, in a situation where there was hardly any. Anyway, so it was all these stories which I really was interested in. My aunt, of course, with the Lovers Rock, and my own story, but that happened later on because it was a bit difficult for me to sort of talk about that. But I thought, okay, I have to, and I was very grateful to do that. And of course, I discovered Alex Wheatle, and I discovered Red, White, and Blue. Which was the story of Leroy Logan through a writer's room which I first set up. But the writer's room turned into an audition room to some extent of who the two writers I wanted to work with, which was Courtney Newland and Alice Siddons.
What do you think you were looking for in that writing room? What was it that kind of you connected with, do you think?
So again, it was one of those things where I went into art. Well, okay, I'm an artist as well, but I could never paint. I could paint. I was a painter, but I can't be in a studio with turpentine and oil paint on my own. I'm a communicator. I'm interested in team sports. I'm interested in motivation and to be motivated. So the whole idea of a writer's room for me was to sort of empty all our handbags on the table and sift through it and find out what was going. You know, what's it all about? So, but during that journey, as there've been many journeys in small acts, it became to me about. You know, working with these two writers, and that was it. And the stories, what I came up with in that writer's room, what emerged in that writer's room was one gentleman was called Alex Wheatle, who was a writer. And Alex's story was, well, through emptying people's handbags, I thought, my God, that's an amazing story. And I said to Alex, would you be interested in helping to write your story? And he didn't want to do it. So basically, I was very interested in helping. I mean, he became an amazing, a contributor to all of the small acts episodes as a person who actually physically experienced that time frame, because obviously we were a bit too young for that. And basically he gave the story to myself and Alice's citizens to sort of to write his story. So that's one thing that came out of it. And also a lady called Helen Bart, who was a researcher, came up with the story of Leroy Logan, with Leroy's story, which I did not know. And that was it. So it's all about institutions, because I was interested in institutions, and that was it. And afterwards, after the writers' room finished, then I sort of put forward, do I want to do something about education? And that was that.
You know, I remember in school, and you'd occasionally have a teacher who was absolutely inspiring, and he would kind of push the kind of the curriculum books to one side and teach you their, you know, the stuff that they felt was important and that you should be learning and you should know about. And for me, this is a great example of what we should be telling our kids, the stories that I've got two boys, you know, who are 8 and 12, and these are the types of stories that they need to hear and they need to know about. It's the histories of our country that need to be shared, and they need to be valued, because you've told them it feels with such truth and such emotion as well.
I mean, the West Indian, the Black community have changed Britain forever. I mean, you think of in the political sphere, in law, in culture, popular culture, in sport. I mean, you know, again, in social, you know, it's all everything. I mean, you know, you see the, you know, popular culture, you see, you know, mod rockers, skinheads, punks, you know, you talk about politics in sense of you know, what happened in Mangrove 9 and how shockwaves that created within education, and the Black parents and teachers who changed the rules in the way of basically dismissing this. There was a part in the education system which had, there was a place where it was called educationally subnormal children, where they put children into these sort of schools, which were basically the faces for backward children, and left them there. And the majority of those kids were obviously the overpopulated areas were Black children were, and of course white children were. But you know, the 5-to-1, there was more Black kids within population were in these schools, and there was Black parents that fought to demolish that and get rid of it. That's the truth. So it's interesting how, as a collective, what we can do. And I think a lot of these things get brushed beneath the carpet because it's just ordinary people who actually do these things. And that's it, really. So I'm just so proud of the West Indian Black community. So proud. Made my life possible.
I love how you've used music across these episodes as well, these fabulous films, because it feels like music can be used so cleverly to manipulate our emotion. But I think for the way that I see that you've used particularly existing music and needle drops is to almost enhance the narrative in a way, in that the lyrics of the songs very much either reaffirm the situation or the atmosphere of where we are and what's going on. And it's so, you know, it's kind of for the songs I didn't know, frantically like Shazam and stuff, so I could, and then when I read the lyrics, it's kind of like, wow, this is saying much more than almost dialogue could in a way. And I wondered if that was an intention and a conscious thing.
Absolutely. I think it's part of the DNA of these stories, the music, because often a lot of these music were sort of were in parallel to what were to the events or reaction to the events. So it's kind of, it was necessary to sort of, that was the soundtrack. That was the sort of the push. And also, I've got to say, you know, it's kind of funny to say, but also food, you know, because, you know, it's home away from home. You can't be home, but you could taste home. So you could think of people like Scorsese doing the same thing, or Hu Haoshan, for, you know, these amazing filmmakers, Asian filmmakers, who are sort of mixing the sort of rituals of the everyday, the senses of the everyday within the narrative, because that's our fuel. That's our fuel.
Did the music start to form a place within the film then whilst you were writing it, in terms of knowing that it had an important part of the narrative?
Yes. I think what's a good example, some examples. When you think of things like Bob Marley, of course, and you think of Trench Town Rock,
in the Pressure prison, Drop, Toots and the Maytals as well. Yeah,
Pressure Drop was amazing, because that was just so, you know, Sean Parks play, you know, in that role was just absolutely incredible. And I remember I knew that one, that it's celebratory track, you know, but at the same time it's like, You know, it's what's up. It's like, you know, it, there's, you know, it's heavy. So he goes outside and he's alone. It just adds so much to the atmosphere. It says all the things that he's thinking.
Yeah.
Pressure Drop is dropping you. That's an amazing track. And Toots, unfortunately, Gorenci Soul died last year, so it was kind of an act that we had so many Toots songs in the anthology. Yeah.
Even
also, things like Blondie, you know,
yeah.
That popped up, you know, because those girls, that's what they were looking at. I remember me on the radio, mate, in the top 40 on a Sunday. You're crazy. Me and my sister in the kitchen.
Fighting bit as well. That's the great thing, I think, as well, is the tone of Lover's Rock is just, you know, you feel like it really reminded me of, it made me feel again how I felt at that age when I was getting ready and putting the music on and getting excited and the possibilities of life.
The possibilities, but also it wasn't pretend, it was real. You know, you went out and you put you got the shoes that you wanted to get, the clothes you wanted to get, or you look good, you look sharp in the mirror, and then you went to that party, and that party was real. The music was real. It wasn't fantasy. It wasn't. I mean, unfortunately, I'm old now. You know what I mean? I remember I still have that rock and roll in me. But you remember, you went to that party and everything was real. The makeup, it wasn't a fantasy. It wasn't just like one time. It was amazing. That's why. I think when we debuted this, we debuted Lover's Rock, Mangrove, and Know What I'm Doing in New York. But we debuted it in New York Film Festival when there was a drive-in theater. They drive-in theaters because, of course, COVID. People were getting out of the car and going nuts. My dream was to put it on in the cinema and then people smashing up the seats. That was my dream. But didn't get that far because of COVID, but there you go. Yeah.
I think it feels like the perfect thing to do when we're allowed to go back to the cinemas, because we're all going to be so excited.
But I understand why you're so, of course, you're obviously a presenter, but also you're deep in music. But I understand that because in some ways it's a truth, and it never stops giving, never stops giving, never stops giving.
I love as well in how Lover's Rock, how the kind of tonal shift of the music as well, and that idea where it gets to a certain point in the party where the lads kind of have their moment where they're all, and I love how that shift that you have is there, where you come back into that room and it's all the guys just kind of, it's got slightly more aggressive and slightly more kind of masculine and sort of testosterone, rather than it being that kind of sensual seduction that we've seen earlier on. And again, the music that you use to kind of highlight that shift, the Investigators and stuff like that, was just a brilliant choice.
Let's be loved.
Investigators, yeah. Oh my god, what a track! Unfortunately, that's not on the iPad. On the soundtrack on the iPad, but get it, you can get it.
Turn out the light. Oh, so good.
You know what's so interesting about that tune and some other tunes, I can't remember what the other tune is when those guys use ooey you. There's a lot of ooey you's in Love Is Rock by male artists. There's an ooey you. I was like, wow, okay. They're okay to sort of have a certain sense of fainess about them and desire. It's the opposite of possibly what people might think of black males in that sense, but it's just a vulnerability, a possibility. It's one of those, it's magic, that's what it is. It's not, sex is something else, but falling in love and feeling that feel is just magic, and you cannot, that's something different, that's amazing. Yeah. So Love Is Rock is about the magic, really. And I think you know, Courtney Newland, who was a co-writer, obviously chose some songs because his mother used to sort of run blues parties as well. But my thing was, there's three tracks for me, which was the pit, which was the sort of pillars, was Comfort Fighting.
Everybody was kung fu fighting. Those kids were fast as lightning. In fact, it was a little bit frightening, but they fought with
obviously Slay Games, and then Kunta Kinte.
The Revolutionaries.
When I heard that, was that Revolutionary? That's Revolutionary. I heard that track, I was looking at, where's this dub record? Are we going to find this dub? Where's this dub? As soon as I heard that track, it was like a dog whistle going off. It was like a dog whistle going off. So, no, that's it. That's when people started mashing up the cinema. For sure.
important when you kind of go through the films of where you've chosen not to use music as well, because that can almost be as important as the decision as to where you do use music. So, like, for example, the not guilty verdict in Mangrove, for example, is such an emotional scene, and there's no music in there, and it makes it even more powerful, I think.
But also in The Riot with Mika Levy. Mika, we worked with Mika, extraordinary. She's extraordinary. And I think, you know, Mika is such a dude. And so, you know, I wanted to be my best friend, please. You're the kind of kid at school you want to hang out with? Just
totally.
You got me, that's Mika.
That score she did for Monos. Oh my God, that was absolutely mind-blowing, yeah.
Thank you. Because she wrote the score for the demonstration, which turned into a fracas with the police. You know, and it's just, and then all of a sudden there's a cut, and it's nothing. It's almost like you cut the strings and gravity, and you fall. So those are moments, and of course she did this beautiful thing we did in the waiting room for the verdict. So before that scene you talk about with Sean Parks, there's a scene where they're in the waiting room, and it's basically the sea. It's in the waiting by the bay. It's almost like they're waiting, and it's basically this huge instrument with shells, and you pour it out one way, and it's still snow. And you know, Mika did this amazing thing, which is subliminal, because you think you don't hear it, and you do hear it. And what is it? Is that the sea? Is that the crashing of the waves on the shore? So that, again, that was very, Mangrove was very important in terms of the music, of obviously picking certain music, you know, a lot of toots. And also, there was a very early track. There's a very, before Scar, Pento, which is a music just before Scar. And also Calypso, we can't remember, and Soca, because again, you know, this is a different island. There's, the thing what Dennis was saying about different islands, that's very important, because the Calypso and the Soca and the reggae, these are different, they're totally different sort of regions of the world as such, as far as sophistication and music interpretations. So that was very much about 68.
Why Mika? What was it about her work or her that she was the right person to?
So it's that tune, Rose. It's that tune, Rose. That tune is like a rose.
Sons of its thorns, it's like a rose, it's like a rose. Let go of his sons, of his sons, and the rain collects in the concrete. It's like a rose that's got rid of his sons. Safe and sound, and the insects will know at your core if you don't grow back your thorns. It's like a rose, let's let go of its thorns.
Wow, I just feel that she's just, I wanted her to do the soundtrack for Widows, but that just didn't happen for some reason. It didn't happen. I just think she's a great artist. And I think she's an interpreter who has a lot of soul. And that's the thing. I think she has a lot of soul, and she's a real kind of, I can't put my finger on it. But
she's quite hard to describe, though, in terms of, I love that about her. She's such a unique, I don't know. Yeah, I just was absolutely in awe. I got to sit in a hotel room with her for an hour and chat to her about Monosh and Under the Skin and Jackie and stuff a couple of years back. And I just, and she's a woman of very few words as well. You know, she doesn't find it easy or kind of, but yeah, I think she's, I'm so excited to see where, you know, where she goes and what she does, because it feels like the kind of world's her oyster, really.
I think, but yeah, is the right thing to say about it. But yeah, you know.
But yeah. I like that. Red, White and Blue is really great, because you have that kind of start where you've got with a car radio, and you have this, like, the dad's listening to country music, and then you have like Tainted Love coming in, and then a bit of Jim Reeves is in there, and it's like, I loved it. It's really fun.
Yeah, I should have my notes. Yeah, Jim Reeves, I mean, that a lot of West Indian people, my father's generation, look big into country. I think the Americans blitzed the airways with a lot of country music, and I think that the association with you know, the religious sort of aspect of country music, the land, because a lot of people were farmers and that. So there was association with the land and spirituality and so forth.
This world is not my home, I'm just a passing through. My treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. The angels beckon me from heaven's open door, and I can't feel at home in this world anymore. Oh Lord, you know I have no friend like you. If heaven's not my home, then Lord, Lord, what will I do? The angels beckon me from heaven's open door, and I can't feel at home in this world anymore.
Oh, one thing I want to talk about is the small faces in Tin Soldier in Mangrove. So what a bad track that is. Damn. And the mods, of course, you know, but yeah, that's great. And that was 68.
To go on a night out dancing with you, because just even your reaction to thinking about a song, you're like that. I'm on the dance floor already.
Yeah. What a voice! That was like some angst. That's like some working class angst. I was like, come on, let's do it. And also, you could do it with, you know, the fact that you could do it with the guitar, the fact that it was immediate and urgent and now, and people responded. I mean, you know, that kind of amazing. There was hardly any kind of a barrier. Anyway, with Red, White, and Blue, then we get into sort of all the Al Green stuff, which is incredible. Oh my God, it's just like incredible stuff.
I hadn't heard for what? How Can You Mend a Broken Heart for a very long time. It was kind of how'd you pick the tracks?
I think you live it. I think, you know, you live it. I think that's a track that spoke to me. You know, again, it's like, you know, one of the beautiful Bee Gees. And how'd you mend, and, you know, the history behind that song, and, you know, they Barry Gibb and his brother having a fallout and coming back together, and the first record they write together is that. It's pretty special, and it goes all the way to the relationship between Leroy Logan and his father. So that was it, really. Yeah.
I can think of younger days when I lived for my life. Was everything a man could want to do. I could never see tomorrow. I was never told about the sorrow. The rain falls in the house. Tell me, how can you stop the old sun from shining? What makes the world go round?
I love the ending to Red, White, and Blue. I love the ending. Are endings easy to decide, you know, when you're in the edit, and I, you know, you've got a script, obviously, so you know, kind of, but I imagine that you have to feel the film whilst you're in the edit in terms of some things work, some things don't.
As a filmmaker, I used to sort of go around with Super 8 camera. So, you know, I had to be these cartridges and they cost like $450. So, you know, I learned to make film through shooting that. So anytime I pressed the button to engage and film my Super 8 camera, oh my God, that's 50 pence. You know, so I was like, shit, I better know what I want to shoot before I shoot it. I have at least a rough idea. So, you know, it's golf, you know, you got a couple of swings at it and that's it. So nowadays people sort of blitz they shoot digitally, they spray their camera all over gaff, you know, 24 hours of film to make something of half an hour and they cut it in the editing room. It's not craft. So for me, that scene, I knew that was the end of the picture. So how we got to the end is how we get to the end, but I knew it was in that scene. And then it's the father, it's Leroy having this sort of conversation. And what's so beautiful about that scene is Steve, who plays the father, that came from who he was. That the whole idea of, you know, that he talks about, you know, his mother saying to him, if you're a grave digger without education, then I'd be disappointed. But if you're a grave digger with education, well, I know that's your choice. And that he was, you know, Steve was telling that to, as a character of Lee Whelan's father to John Berger. But that is something his mother told John. Sorry, Steve. And Steve wanted to be an actor. So we're just using that personal stuff to sort of put into the narrative of our story. And that happened just on set. We were talking and getting deep. And he just said this, you know, the throwaway things. And no. We're using that. So when you see him go there, he's going this. I knew, and the whole idea of what they said at the end, you know, scorch the earth and start again. So, and we ended that film with another Al Green song, which is absolutely beautiful. Lay your head on my pillow.
Don't look so sad. I know it's over. But life goes on, and this world keeps on turning. Yeah, let's just be glad we had this time to spend together. There is no need to watch the bridges that we're burning. Lay your head.
Marvin Gaye as well in there, which was just like, yeah.
Gotta give him up.
Yeah. Here's my Marvin Gaye claim to fame.
What? Wait a minute.
Marvin's brother, Frankie, was married to my mother's aunt.
You're joking. Really?
Yep.
Fuck you. That's incredible. So what did you find out about Marvin?
Not loads, actually, but Frankie came when we were in Scotland, when we lived in Scotland. My granddad had a tiny little family-run hotel, and Frankie and Irene and their little girl, April, they came to visit. And I've got this amazing picture of Frankie in my granddad's kilt outside the hotel. And, I mean, he was the spitting image of Marvin. It was insane. And a voice to die for as well. We used to have a little dinner dance on a Saturday night, and he got up and sang this song that Frankie had written called That's Okay. And I still remember it. He was amazing. He was such a lovely, kind man. And I still keep in touch with Irene. She's out in Santa Monica living still. My little claim to fame. Yeah. One day I'll sit down and chat to Irene about it and get some stories off her for sure. One day.
No, well, yeah. Well, Marvin in Belgium, that was always, and then dating this Belgian princess, that was always interesting. He was at the mangrove too, Marvin. He was hanging out at the mangrove. In the 80s, for sure, yeah.
Wow. It feels like there could almost be like a whole series of films about the mangrove.
Yeah, people like Vanessa Redgrave was hanging out in the mangroves. Oh, yeah. It was swinging. The mangrove was swinging. for sure.
When you were writing it, because the casting in all these films is just brilliant. You talk about John Boyega in Red, White and Blue and Letitia. Oh my God, that girl is just, with every scene that she's in, she just gets to the core of you. She's amazing.
She still went there. She went there. And of course, you must understand that, you know, a lot of the time people are playing themselves for the first time. You know, you got a lot of black actors who never get the opportunity to sort of, you know, play their mother or play their, you know, play people who they're attached to. You know, and that's the thing, you know, for a long time, black people were not welcome within the British film and TV industry in this country. It's a fact. The vast majority of people you see on screen, apart, of course, to Letitia, you see Letitia and John, of course, a lot of them have never been on screen before ever. You know, you know, Amira from Lovers Rock, other people, Kenya from Education, Shay from Alex Wheatle. Yeah, he was his first year in drama school.
Oh my God, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, he just turned into drama school for the first year. I think he was doing it for the first year, but before he went there for a few months and then he was just working with us. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's it. So there's just a lot of talent out there that unfortunately needs to shine. That's all.
Steve, I could chat to you all day, and I really appreciate you taking the time to chat to me today about these. I mean, I feel like I could almost have done an hour long on every one of the films, to be honest, because there's just a wealth to talk about, both, you know, in terms of the music, but also the stories and the performances and all that. But thank you so much for these films, because being a mum, I feel like I there's a point where I need to show my kids, my boys, these films sort of thing, because I think they're stories that they need to hear. And I thank you very much for giving these characters' voices. So thank you so much, Steve, for your time today and for these wonderful films.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure talking to you. So I always get excited. I always get, oh, wow, it's just having a chat. It's like, great. It's not an interview, which is fantastic.
I want to go for a dance with you next time. That's what I want to do.
Can you imagine? It'd be better me, you, Dennis, smashing up some chairs.
Let's have a screening of all five films, and we have like a half-hour dance-off in between each film and just see where it goes.
Listen, I'm just waiting for the day to happen when we can actually get to cinema and show it and, yeah, have a good, you know, good sound and actually do it. Anyway, moving on. Swiftly.
Yeah. All right, my dear. You take care. Thanks, bye. Steve. From the soundtrack to Red, White and Blue, that's Got to Give Up by Marvin Gaye, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Steve McQueen and Dennis Bevel. My huge thanks to Steve and Dennis for taking the time to talk to us. All five episodes of Steve's Small Axe series are available to watch on the BBC iPlayer now and are each fantastic and really important bits of filmmaking, I think. If you want to hear my first conversation with Steve, head to edithbowman.com, where you'll also be able to find every guest I've interviewed for this podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And please do, if you can, have a little look at our YouTube channel for a show that I put together as a companion piece to this show. Next up, I'm really looking forward to sharing this episode with you because I had a lot of fun making it. Sacha Baron Cohen is a bit of a genius when it comes to what he does. No one else does what he does. And one of the things that I think has never really been talked about with regards to all these characters that he's created, of course we know Borat, Bruno, Ali G, is the music. And guess who writes the music? His brother, Eran Baron Cohen. And he is next week's guest. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.